Court will proceed to the third case, Diamond versus Porsche Cars. Mr. Cohen.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'll focus on the central issue in this case, as this is essentially a pleading issue. The question before the Court is whether or not plaintiffs properly allege the existence of a written warranty pursuant to Section 23016 of the Warranty Act, and more particularly, as the District Court hinged its analysis on one element, the last paragraph of the definition of a written warranty, whether or not that written warranty was actually issued in connection with a sale for purposes other than resale. In finding against the plaintiff, the District Court essentially set aside the well-pled allegations in plaintiff's amended complaint. The District Court, in doing so, relied on presumptions of fact from a case out of the state of New York, the New York High Court, Vicentio versus Daimler-Chrysler, and also relied upon a conclusion that the District Court believed that the plaintiff's allegations were controverted by express language in the subject lease.
Before you get to that, how have the Diamond sustained damage of more than $50,000, and how should that be calculated? Because I think you have real problems there.
And to answer the Court in all frankness and to also at the same time not talk out of both sides of my mouth, I think that the procedural history is important. This case was filed in the Circuit Court of Cook County. The plaintiff filed it there. The plaintiff, the case was then removed by the defendant on jurisdiction grounds. We filed a motion to remand where we claimed that there was not jurisdiction. We are now before the Court as our motion to remand was denied by the District Court. I cannot answer this Court and say that affirmatively there are damages in excess of $50,000. I think if I did that, I would be contradicting our earlier pleadings.
Yeah, because even if the plaintiff's got a total refund on the lease payments that had been made, that amounts to what? A little over $10,000, $11,000?
Well, it would amount to, correct, it would be slightly more than that because the lease was over the period of 39 months. The total of the lease payments wind up being $40,000, but certainly less than $50,000. As this Court has reminded us in the past in Gardinsky-Leshek versus Ford Motor Company, you also can't end the inquiry there. You have to subtract out the current value of the car. However, as faced with a dispositive motion that eventually got rid of our claims, and this Court being the Court to address those issues and to attempt to have recourse for my clients, we are here pursuant to the dismissal on the merits of our claims. And I would ask this Court then indulgence to be able to hopefully address those issues, unless the Court is convinced on the jurisdictional grounds, in which case I believe I'd have nothing else to say.
Yeah, then it would just be a remand to the District Court to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Correct.
The District Court leaves me a little puzzled by footnote 2 in its order.
And I understand, Your Honor. In all frankness, it places the plaintiffs as well as other consumers, unfortunately, in a quandary.
Yes.
This opinion is out there. This is an opinion that's being cited to, relied upon, in fact, relied upon by other judges within the Northern District. For all intents and practical purposes, as most of these claims are filed in state courts, and state courts look to federal district courts and courts of appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court when applicable, we have a situation where that opinion will still be in existence. The opinion will not be wiped out in its entirety. Courts can still rely upon it for purposes of persuasive authority, although the case has been remanded on jurisdictional grounds. And it is for those reasons that we seek to address the merits of this case before this Court, if this Court deems that appropriate.
Well, you can proceed, although there remains a question, at least for one judge.
For me, too.
That's the subject matter jurisdiction.
Yeah, I think it's a real problem. I mean, you're basically conceding there we don't have it because you don't have the amount. But I understand why you're here because what happened in terms of the district court, but that's very problematic.
And I understand that, but I'm faced, unfortunately, with a dilemma. And the dilemma is that my client's claims were dismissed, and there is no other form of recourse. And I cannot and I will not talk out of both sides of my mouth and try to argue for purposes of overturning the district court that there is jurisdiction. With the Court's indulgence, I will address some of the merits, then, of the case. As I was indicating, the district court relied on provisions in the subject lease as well as presumptions from the case of Vicentio versus Daimler Chrysler. I'll address each one of those in particular, starting with the presumption. In Vicentio, and it's interesting, that was a motion to dismiss based on the pleadings, and perhaps due to factual inadequacies in the record, the Vicentio court made the statement that presumably resale is an intrinsic part of the leasing company's plan. It is plaintiff's contention that it was improper for the district court to have actually relied upon these facts outside of the record, let alone presumptions. These facts were not even based upon testimony or evidence. This was a presumption from the Vicentio court. And in the case of Barr, it's very possible, and we do not know the actual reason for purchase other than what the plaintiff pled. The leasing company perhaps may have leased the car again. The leasing company, Porsche Financial Services, may have continued to use the vehicle by one of their managers. We do not know the reason. But for the district court to hinge its analysis in part on these presumptions was improper. And secondly, the district court also hinged its analysis on boilerplate language in the subject lease. In particular, a default provision, which interestingly is in every retail installment contract, as well as just leases, and in addition, a purchase option provision. And the district court found that these provisions were conclusive evidence to override the plaintiff's well-pled allegation that the court was required to accept as true that the leasing company actually purchased the car for resale purposes. These provisions tell us nothing more than what will happen in the event that the consumer, that the plaintiffs in this case, stop making their payments, or if the plaintiffs elect down the road to buy the vehicle. They do not tell us at all why the leasing company, Porsche Financial Services, purchased the car. Nowhere in the actual lease agreement at all does it tell us why Porsche Financial Services purchased the car. The only evidence from the record whatsoever as to why they purchased it, the only direct evidence, are the allegations contained within plaintiff's amended complaint. Defendant, in its brief, in fact, on page 13 and 14 of its brief, admits that Porsche Financial Services acquired the car for purposes of selling the use to plaintiffs. That supports our allegations. The district court's reliance on extraneous provisions in the subject lease is reliance on circumstantial evidence at best. As the district court was required to give deference to plaintiff's allegations and view them in a light most favorable to plaintiff, it is our contention that the district court erred in hinging its analysis on that aspect of the law. Now, we are not before this court saying that there's a hard and fast rule, that leases apply in every single case. What we're saying is that there are factual issues that must be ascertained during discovery, that perhaps this should have been the subject of a summary judgment motion, but we should have been given the opportunity to at least prove our allegations, as we did in a case that I provided to this court pursuant to Rule 28, Cohen versus American General, where Judge Moran recognized, based upon testimony in the record, that the leasing company purchased the vehicle only to facilitate the sale or only to facilitate the lease. That was their reason for purchase. That what happens down the road, although may be in some ways relevant to the subsequent actions of the leasing company, does not go back to their actual reason for purchase. That but for the fact that this dealership found a consumer willing to lease the vehicle, and in turn, the leasing company, Porsche Financial Services, agreed to lease it, the transaction never would have taken place. The leasing company, Porsche Financial Services, never would have bought this car but for that fact. And these are the allegations in our complaint, and these are allegations that if we are given the opportunity that we can prove, and as I mentioned, maybe not in all cases, but I think that for purposes of a motion to dismiss, it was improper for the district court to have set aside our allegations based upon circumstantial evidence at best and presumptions of fact. This was defendant's motion. This was defendant's burden. The defendant presented no evidence to controvert our evidence. Based upon our allegations and the fact that the court was required to accept them as true, we would respectfully urge that this district court reverse the district court's opinion and remand this case for further proceedings. And I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, unless this court has any further questions.
Not at this time. Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Mr. Wojcicki?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to address the mountain controversy issue first. Obviously, it's a fundamental issue. We do not just look at what plaintiff may or may not recover in the action. We look at the amount in controversy as a consequence of the claims. One of the claims here, count three, deals with revocation. In other words, let's unwind the deal. They asked for revocation against Porsche cars of North America, a non-party to the lease in question. What that means is this. In the event plaintiffs were found to have properly revoked acceptance against Porsche Cars of North America, Porsche Cars of North America would not only be responsible for refunding some or all of plaintiffs' lease payments, but they would also be responsible for purchasing the vehicle for its residual value of $49,000, over almost $49,600. They'd be responsible for the early termination fee of $350. That puts us just about at the 50. We're pennies under the $50,000 requirement before we even get the plaintiff's relief of refund of any kind of payments they made under the lease, license, title, taxes, all that kind of thing.
And do you have any cases that support this novel kind of calculation that you're making?
It's not novel. The cases that talk about in controversy never limit the analysis to what the plaintiff may or may not require. It's what's in controversy throughout the entire suit. Revocation, the value of the recovery to the plaintiff is that they get out from under portions of the lease. They're no longer responsible for residual value. They can terminate the lease early without being responsible for residual value.
And is that square with Gorinsky?
Gorinsky-Lestruck?
Yes.
We believe it does.
If
you look, because you have to look at what plaintiff's maximum recovery is, and where Gorinsky-Lestruck starts out is that the potential maximum recovery is the price paid for the car. Theoretically, the car could be worth zero. What you got was absolute worth zero. You may be entitled to a full refund, complete rescission of the deal. And so if the car's price...
And so rescission of the deal, wouldn't they be entitled to get the lease payments back that they had paid, which is about $11,000?
They would be entitled to get the relief payments, and then Porsche would be on the hook for the remainder of the lease, the remainder of the rent, in addition to the residual value, early termination fee. All of that is in controversy. Whether the money flows back to the plaintiff, flows back to a leasing company, flows back to a creditor, makes no difference in terms of looking what's in controversy. What is Porsche's ultimate exposure or potential liability here? It's not limited to what its liability or potential liability is to the plaintiff. That $49,000 residual value is no less in controversy than plaintiff saying, I want my lease payments back. That's our position, because otherwise you're taking a non-realistic view of really what's in dispute, what that issue in the case.
And again, I ask you, do you have a case that does the calculation in the way that you've done it?
We think our calculation is consistent with Gardeski-Lestruck. That was a purchase that involved an $18,000 car, and the court there said you have to look at purchase price. That's where you start your analysis, because that is your basic amount in controversy, and then you add or subtract to it based on different factors in the case.
And you don't think the fact that this is a lease changes that?
It changes what plaintiffs can recover, what their measure of damages is, but it doesn't change the overall exposure of Porsche. Porsche's overall potential exposure, whether it's a sale or a lease, if you're going to unwind the deal, it's the cost of that deal, the cost, the purchase price of the car
that's
agreed upon.
Why is that their exposure? How do you get that as exposure?
If it were determined that plaintiffs rightfully revoked acceptance, what revocation is to unwind the deal and put the parties back where they were as if the transaction never occurred. So plaintiffs would get all of their payments back,
and
all their lease money.
Porsche has title to the car.
And Porsche gets the car, but it has to pay off the lease. It has to pay off early termination fees. It has to pay off unaccumulated rent charges, and it has to pay off residual value.
It only gets up into the mid-40s, though, doesn't it?
The residual value of the car is $49,600. So that's the check it has to cut. It's got a $350 early termination fee that it's going to have to pay to the lease company. It's got unaccumulated rent charges for the remainder of this term of the lease that it has to pay to the leasing company.
What's the option to buy worth?
Excuse me?
What's the option to buy worth?
The option to buy is worth the residual value plus unpaid past due payments, license, title, taxes, official fees, and unaccumulated rent through the remainder of the lease. Also, plaintiffs here filed this case in the law division of the Circuit Court of Cook County. The minimum level of jurisdiction, the minimum amount of controversy in that case, or requirement to file a case in the law division is $50,000. So when a plaintiff comes up here and says, well, I don't want to speak out of both sides of my mouth, they've already done that by filing this case in a forum that requires a $50,000 amount in controversy for the action to be filed there.
But they filed in a court of general jurisdiction. It could go to another if it was in the wrong division, it isn't a court system that could handle the case, though, right?
The court, it's not a matter of jurisdiction in Cook County, but the point is the plaintiffs, by filing in the law division, are telling the Circuit Court of Cook County that the amount of controversy in this action does indeed exceed $50,000. Plaintiffs don't want to be in a federal forum, so when we get to federal court, when the defendant exercised properly, we submit its right to removal, the plaintiff takes the position that, no, the amount of controversy is not met. And, by the way, that motion was heard and ruled on. Quite frankly, I was quite surprised by footnote 2 in the judge's opinion as well, because that issue had, in fact, been dealt with, and it was not a matter of assumption. It was a matter based on, and again, I didn't address it in my brief because it was addressed below, and I didn't think it was an issue. It certainly wasn't raised by the plaintiff, although certainly the court is free to do so. It was an issue.
Obliged to do so.
Excuse me?
When it comes to jurisdiction, we're obliged to do so.
Exactly. I mean, I understand that. And I wasn't wholly unprepared for the question today, but like I said, I was surprised because there was a determination. We looked at residual value and all the other matters that we've discussed today, including looking at the transaction as a whole and not just focusing on what plaintiff may or may not recover. We think that is entirely consistent with Gardinsky-Lestrak. And one of the differences between that case and this is in the Gardinsky-Lestrak case, there was no claim for revocation. All that was in dispute was diminution in value as a consequence of alleged defects. They were not suing to unwind the deal. And that changes, obviously adds to what is in dispute, what's in controversy, what the potential exposure and liability of the defendant is. Turning now to the merits of this case, plaintiffs seem to acknowledge and go to great lengths to show that a sale occurred here, why they concede that a sale is necessary to give rise to trigger application of the Magnuson-Moss Act. They didn't buy the car. They're not the party to a sale. The car wasn't transferred to them, so they have to look somewhere else to find a sale. We start out, if we look at the original complaint filed here, with the facts alleged as they occurred, that the plaintiffs leased this vehicle from Westmont Porsche and returned to Westmont Porsche for warranty service, and that Westmont Porsche is the lessor, et cetera, et cetera. When our motion to dismiss is filed, plaintiffs file an amended complaint prior to filing response saying, wait a minute, we're going to plead a different transaction because the way we pleaded it originally knocks us out of the box under the Magnuson-Moss Act, so we're going to reconfigure the transaction. We're going to say that, no, it wasn't Westmont that was the lessor. In fact, it was Porsche Finance, the company to which the lease was assigned, and that Porsche Finance went and jumped in, and this transaction magically occurred somehow before this lease was consummated between the plaintiffs and Westmont. Well, plaintiffs' well-pleaded allegations, as they refer to it, or refer to them, are really not so well-pleaded. They are contradictory to the facts stated in the lease, and whereas here an action is based on a written instrument, and that written instrument is part of the pleadings here, it's attached to the complaint. It would have been equally appropriate simply to attach it to our motion to dismiss under Rule 10C. That written instrument prevails over contrary allegations in the complaint. What does the lease show us? It shows us that Westmont is indeed the lessor. It shows that Omega Marketing, of which plaintiff Jacqueline Diamond is the president, is the lessee, and it shows that her husband, Christopher Chris, is a co-signer. So it shows that the plaintiffs acknowledge that this is a lease, not a sale, that it is a true lease, that they have no ownership rights in the vehicle. We also know that as part of the lease, the warranty or the right to seek repairs under the warranty was passed down to the lessee by the lessor being Westmont. And what we know is that the lessor, Westmont, is not a buyer for purposes of the Magnuson-Moss Act. When that ability to seek warranty repairs was transferred to the plaintiffs, that was not in the form of a written warranty as defined by the Magnuson-Moss Act, and Westmont could not assign to the plaintiffs greater rights than it had. Westmont would certainly not be considered a consumer, a buyer, someone who has a right to file suit under the Magnuson-Moss Act. To conclude that would turn the Magnuson-Moss Act on its head. So what plaintiffs received was exactly what Westmont had, which is the limited warranty, enforceable by its terms under the Illinois Common Law UCC, but not subject to Magnuson-Moss. The lease also says that the first thing that happens when the lease is signed by Westmont is that the all right title interest in the vehicle is transferred to, strike that, that the terms of the lease are accepted, and then the lease and the vehicle is transferred to Porsche Financial. So at the time Porsche Financial took the lease, time of assignment, there were no warranty rights to come with it. So there were no warranty rights to flow through Porsche Financial and back to the plaintiff. And if you were to conclude otherwise, you would then be turning Porsche Financial into a consumer. Now, that would be, one, judicial legislation, because the Magnuson-Moss Act is not intended to protect and encompass financing companies and business entities that are in the automobile leasing, financing, selling business. It is intended to protect retail consumers, the general public, who buy, and the language of the Act is very clear, who buy consumer products. Why? Because they're the ones who need protection, not business entities involved in the business of buying, selling, or financing automobile purchases. In addition, why is sale important versus a lease? This court should refrain from judicial legislation and extend the Magnuson-Moss to leases. Why? Because you have a much different interest if you are the plaintiff, if you're the member of the general public who obtains use of the car under a lease, than if you go and buy it. If you buy it, you take the risk of its devaluing, of a diminished value as a consequence of defects or problems. Here, on the other hand, when you have a lease, you don't have that kind of commitment to the vehicle. You don't have that expenditure of funds where you take a loss or a significant hit, as it were, in the event the vehicle proves defective. You can go against your lessor to get out of the vehicle. You can early terminate. There's different provisions for that. You don't have the same level of risk and financial commitment, and you aren't likely to sustain the same degree or level of financial loss. Plus, the measure of value of damages here is one of loss of use only. Okay, under the lease, all you get is the right to drive, possess the car. You don't have ownership interest. If a part goes bad, there's not the real incentive to repair it. I mean, if a plaintiff gets money under a lease before the lease is terminated for defects in the vehicle and they surrender the car back, there's no real incentive for them to make the repairs or have the repairs done for the purported breach of warranty, but rather just to thrust that back on the owner of the vehicle, which is the leasing company. In the final analysis, if you look at this transaction, it is one that is not subject to the scope of Magnuson-Moss, and it should not be brought in, because to do so would be judicial legislation, and it would turn, in some respect, the Magnuson-Moss Act on its ear, because now non-consumers, clearly non-consumers, but businesses involved in the automobile industry would now be able to seek its protections, and that is certainly not what the Act is all about. Another key issue here deals with the issues that plaintiff did not raise in their brief, and those are the other grounds that the trial court ruled on the implied warranty count, and that is the absence of privity. Again, it's a matter of statutory construction. The Magnuson-Moss Act defines implied warranty as one arising under state law. The Magnuson-Moss Act does not create, impose, or give rise to any warranties, and in particular does not give rise to implied warranties. If it doesn't exist under state law, it doesn't exist, and it's not actionable under Magnuson-Moss. The federal district courts and federal circuit courts, the Second Circuit, the D.C. Circuit, have all agreed with our and the district court's analysis and construction of the Magnuson-Moss Act, saying you look to state law. If state law requires privity, as it does in Illinois, and there is no privity, and there is none between plaintiff and Porsche based on the clear allegations, then there is no state law implied warranty, and so therefore there is no implied warranty to enforce under Magnuson-Moss. Now, the Illinois Supreme Court has said, well, there are provisions that prohibit the disclaimer or modification of implied warranties, and we read them broadly to mean that means that the implied warranty comes into being for Magnuson-Moss. That ruling needs, the Illinois Supreme Court needs to be disabused, not because they were necessarily wrong, but because they're different. And because they're different than what the federal courts say, they are wrong in their interpretation of the Act. And right now, because of the competing decisions, that is why we have forum shopping. That's why plaintiffs want to and fight so hard to stay in state court. They don't want to be in federal court, where they know the implied warranty claim is going to go, and other issues like that, including, we think, revocation, given the similarity there, that it really makes no sense to allow revocation against a remote manufacturer who's not a party to the transaction that is being unwound. Put the parties back in status quo, put the parties to the transaction, the lessee and the lessor, the buyer, the seller. It does not make sense. It's economically irrational. The cost, and I see my time is up, the cost to the to the importer, warranter, distributor in this case are far greater than what it received in the transaction. You're not putting back parties to status quo. You're changing the status quo by bringing in a non-party. With that, I appreciate the court's time and attention. If there are no further questions, I'll wrap up by simply saying we ask that the district court be affirmed in all respects. Thank you.
Mr. Cohen.
Thank you. I'll start out by addressing the jurisdictional issue again, as I think that that was something that the court paid particular attention to in counsel's remarks about foreign shopping. The cases that we file in the circuit court as this court, Circuit Court of Cook County, if it's filed in law division, is to protect a jurisdictional addendum, to be able to ask for damages that are above a certain amount. That's a different analysis than the Gardinsky-Leshek court, the Seventh Circuit's analysis, where the court, for purposes of jurisdiction, the court recognized that you cannot just look at the full amount that you're seeking. For purposes of jurisdiction, there is a credit for the use, there's not only credit for the use of the vehicle, there's also a credit for the value of the vehicle that the defendant will receive upon having to repurchase the entire vehicle. Here, we actually have some figures that we could look at. We have the lease agreement itself. The lease agreement shows that the residual value of the vehicle at the end of 39 months would be $49,000. So, if you look at that in a logical sense, the residual value prior to 39 months, inherently, if you forget anything regarding the defects in the vehicle, the residual value itself would have to be greater than $49,000, which means that when you take the Gardinsky-Leshek court's calculation and you subtract out $49,000 plus from the total amount of the price of this car, which was $72,500, there's no way that the jurisdictional threshold could be met. By filing this action in the state court and asking for damages in excess of $50,000, we preserved our addendum for the ability to do so, but at the same time recognized, as we learned our lesson before this court in the case of Masana versus Mercedes-Benz, where the jury awarded $75,000 to the plaintiff and the court remanded the action based on jurisdictional grounds, finding that the amount of the value of that particular Mercedes vehicle when subtracted from the jury's verdict was not $50,000. The court found that jurisdiction was not met. To file actions in the federal court to go to trial to win, in that case, a $75,000 verdict, to only have the entire verdict wiped out, remanded, and sent back to state court is not something that we choose to make a practice of doing, and that's why the case was filed in state court. As to some of the issues that counsel raised, and I think it's important that counsel is attempting to make a distinction between the leasing company's rights and the consumer's rights, and I'm not even sure that this court needs to make that distinction because the Act doesn't make that distinction. The Act does not say that businesses may not maintain a cause of action. The Act identifies consumers in three manners. It does not exclude businesses, in this case Porsche Financial Services, so to suggest that Porsche Financial Services is not the entity that the Congress sought to protect may be in part true. But that is belied by the plain language of the statute. The plain language of the statute provides protection to any buyer. It provides protection to any transferee of the consumer product and anyone entitled to enforce the warranty. Whereas in this case, Porsche Financial Services bought the vehicle. The assignment clause bears that out. And our pleading bears that out. They bought the vehicle. The same moment they bought the vehicle, as we plead, they received defendant's written warranty, a warranty that if they would have just kept the vehicle, they could have enforced. But as incorporated in the lease agreement and by virtue of the assignment clause, they became the lessor. They accept the monthly payments every month. Westmont Porsche is not the plaintiff's lessor. That's not who the plaintiffs pay every month. The actual lessor in this case is Porsche Financial Services. That is who the plaintiffs pay. Porsche Financial Services, when they bought the vehicle, received the warranty, signed the warranty, as we plead in our complaint, for the plaintiffs to be able to use and enjoy and enforce. And as we plead in our complaint, they did that. They took the vehicle in for warranty repairs. To suggest, then, that they would not be able to receive the benefits of that warranty simply because Porsche Financial Services may have purchased the vehicle for other purposes, for purposes, say, or for resale, which, in fact, defendant doesn't have conclusive evidence to that, would render prongs 2 and 3 of the definition of a consumer illusory. The statute was not drafted to stop at the first buyer at retail. In fact, that was the initial definition, the very first version of the Act. The statute has two other mechanisms to allow anyone who has the benefit of a warranty to be able to enforce it. To recognize otherwise would render the statute illusory. It would render the warranty that the plaintiff had in this case unenforceable. For the reasons espoused in our brief and for the reasons that I've articulated, we would ask not only that this court reverse the district court, but if this court is inclined on jurisdictional grounds to remand, we would ask for this court to also essentially ask that the district court opinion be removed from any publications as the effect of that opinion has been broad-reaching to state courts as well as to other courts. If this court does not have any other questions, I will end my argument.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.